I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hi everyone, and welcome to the virtual London Review Bookshop for this conversation between me, Juliet Jakes, and my good friend and one of my favourite writers, Owen Hatherley. Lots of you will know Owen, I'm sure. He's an astonishingly prolific writer. Books include Militant Modernism, Uncommon People, the book about the band Pulp, A Guide to the New Ruins of Great Britain, A New Kind of Bleak, The Chaplin Machine, The Ministry of Nostalgia, Trans-Europe Express, Landscapes of Communism, The Adventures of Owen Hatherley in the Post-Soviet Space. I'm sure that's not all of them, but the new one is an anthology of his work, Clean Living Under Difficult Circumstances. Which one did I forget, Owen?
Which did you forget? There's a small book I published from a Russian publisher, and it was only print on demand, so it's totally fine. Nobody's read it in any in either language.
Okay, and none of that.
You know, it's popular in Belarus. Anthology. They love it in Minsk.
Oh, I bet they do. So we're here to talk about your new book, Clean Living Under Difficult Circumstances, which is an anthology of your writing between about 2005 and 2019. I mean, I'll ask the first question, which is why that title? What does it mean?
So it comes from one of the sort of several managers of The Who, a group who I don't particularly like, apart from their first few singles before Roger Daltrey starts doing that awful kind of caterwauling that all English rock singers started doing at a certain point. And it's from a guy called Pete Meaden, who was one of their early managers. And he was asked in the 70s when Mod had kind of died, before it was revived, what it actually was. And he came up with this as a definition. He said, you know, modernism, mod living is about clean living under difficult circumstances. And I think that's a really interesting way of defining a particular kind of modernism that has always interested me. And it's the thing that kind of links, two kinds of things that one can broadly describe as modernism together, which otherwise are quite unlike each other, which is the sort of modern movement tradition in design from the sort of Bauhaus and constructivism onwards, and the other thing being pop music and pop culture, I guess, roughly from jazz in the 1920s onwards. And these two things, you know, are both about this kind of idea of sort of reforming or changing life rather than just simply, you know, doing interesting things in galleries or what have you. And it also does a thing which it's sort of an implicit riposte for me to a particular idea of what modernism is, which came in the 1990s with things like John Carey's book, The Intellectuals and the Masses, which is that, you know, that modernism is a sort of trick played on the reader, all of the kind of formal innovation is really all about making it hard to read and making it possible that only the cognoscenti can read it. And obviously, I think this is bullshit. And one of the places you can most see it's bullshit is in those two things, is in kind of pop culture and in design, where they were. And, you know, in the first instance, explicitly aimed at ordinary people, and the second instance, overwhelmingly made by ordinary people rather than by a small minority of intellectuals. That's what's going on there.
Yeah, and I mean, it sort of seems to me that this really is a book about popular modernism. And maybe you could talk a bit about the blog culture that your writing sort of emerged out of. There's not much of your writing from the blogs in this book, but there is some. And the introduction puts a lot of your writing career into that context of this blog culture. So maybe you could talk a bit about the importance of this sort of concept of popular modernism to the blogging sphere that you spent your early to sort of mid-20s working within.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of, I mean, this is a huge generalization because there are all sorts of people doing all sorts of blogs. Even in the small group that we were in, there was, you know, I guess a sort of divide between different factions, you know, a sort of people that posted on I Love Music and people that posted on Dissensus. And I posted on both, so I had very divided loyalties, although overwhelmingly on the Dissensus side, obviously. I think a lot of it was about a sort of feeling that, I guess, the kind of John Carey type people had won, you know, that the kind of idea that you could do something like Ghost by Japan, or that you could build, you know, experimental social housing for ordinary people, that both of these things were considered not just impossible, not just even that they were kind of inherently elitist and bad and evil, but also that they never had happened. And that to think that they had happened was in some way a kind of an example of nostalgia, and to criticize the kind of culture of the 2000s, which I think we can now all agree was absolutely terrible. Was in some way being, you know, sort of made you nostalgic and wrongheaded and so on. And I suppose we were all sort of trying to, various different ways and various different subjects, trying to kind of, you know, have some sort of fidelity, to use the word Darren Ambrose uses about Mark Fisher, to those ideas, and sort of point out that they did happen, that they were real, and that it would be nice to do it. And I think that's the thing, that's sort of the continuity. And the other thing that you know, that was going on in all of that, which I think is less attractive, and a thing that was very much a kind of shape of things to come, was that everyone that had a blog was an absolutely, well, not everyone, I can imagine some people going like, not me, but most everyone was an absolutely inveterate self-promoter and self-brander. Like, you know, everybody on it, like long before this became kind of ubiquitous on you know, the kind of later social networks like Instagram and Twitter and so forth, everyone on there had an incredibly highly curated personal brand, which in many ways, I suppose, stands you in quite good stead for journalism, you know, and it kind of, I suppose, you know, it's not so good for developing ideas in any great depth. But it was, you know, it was basically the crucial thing was just that it felt like a cultural wasteland at that point. And finding all of that stuff, which I found very much from outside, I didn't know any of those people at the time, was incredibly exciting, because if you'd kind of like grown up thinking that pop culture was incredibly important, and then everyone told you that it wasn't, usually the people writing about pop culture told you that it wasn't in the Observer Music Monthly or whatever. And you then found all these people that still, you know, that still fervently believed. It was very, very exciting, and also just sort of reassuring. It made you feel like you weren't totally and utterly alone. Does that answer the question?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
I think it does. Yeah. No, that's very nice. And I'm going to ask you something that I'm really interested in, having had quite a complex relationship with writing about myself, writing autobiographically, and writing cultural criticism, trying to find some kind of way of maybe marrying those two things. You know, you do not do a lot of directly autobiographical writing, although, you know, your personality and your interests come across very strongly. And, you know, maybe what you were just saying about sort of developing a personal brand, like, you know, whether that's done intentionally or not, that does come across very strongly in all of your work, I think. But this book opens with a quite directly autobiographical piece of writing, where you talk about your childhood growing up around in Hampshire on the South Coast, in Southampton and elsewhere, about your mother and her politics and her relationship to the housing system and the benefits system. And, you know, your interest in sort of, you know, music and the effects of going to university and relationships on your life and so forth in a way that I haven't really seen you do that much elsewhere. So I wanted to ask you, like, how it felt to write in that mode and, like, why you chose to introduce the book and to sort of pepper the book with these autobiographical segments.
Sure. I remember a couple of years ago, my mum saying that she thought that I never wrote about myself and my writing was quite unemotional. And I found this very strange because I thought it did. Like, I once got, when I was a blogger, like an anonymous email headed Hatherley Watch, which said something along the lines of, like, yes, yes, we know you grew up on a council estate in Southampton and your parents were a militant. We're watching you. And I thought, I have my theories on who sent that. But anyway, so even then, it was not 2008. Even then, like, that shtick was pretty obvious. And I most of my books, particularly the ones on architecture, not so much the ones that are not, or at least two of the ones that are not. So not really in Chaplin Machine, which came from my brief attempt to be an academic, and The Ministry of Nostalgia, which is sort of vaguely historical. The others are all absolutely full of autobiography. They're all full of sort of me very much putting myself at the centre of a thing and going, like, here am I, who am from here doing this. So in a way that people don't generally do in architecture, certainly people don't do that. Everyone kind of acts as if they are, you know, all sort of like floating minds, you know, floating above class and society and so forth, which I think is a way of hiding the fact that they all went to the same schools. So I thought I already did. And so I thought it was quite natural doing a kind of anthology of 15 years of work, because when I kind of came up with it as an idea, I was like, oh, there is exactly 15 years. It goes from 2005 to 2020. So there's this exact kind of 15-year stretch, which seemed very, very neat and very symmetrical. I thought, well, I'll obviously kind of do something on, like, how we got from A to B and how I got from A to B. And I thought it would be fun to just do a kind of, like the first draft of it, which, you know, because you've read, is basically about, like, was an attempt to sort of do a Pevsner guide to everywhere I'd lived and where what was happening in my life at the time. So it sort of had the address of each place and then, like, a kind of paragraph description, and it was rubbish. And you read it and said it was rubbish. My partner said it was rubbish. Lindsay Hanley read it and said it was rubbish. Like, everyone said it was shit. My editor said it was shit. So I was like, oh, dear, this really hasn't worked. So I sat down again and kind of, like, just tried to write it out like I would normally write a thing, you know, just like kind of breaking up this attempt to write something vaguely experimental and instead just kind of go, just treat it like a normal kind of conversational thing. But I suppose it's a fragment of something that I've sort of also wanted to do for a while. I've kind of wanted to write about some of these things. Partly, actually, because I find it sort of easier to write about it the further you get away from it. The less those things are painful, the more it's kind of like, oh, I can, you know, smile about it now. Damn, it was terrible, as our friend from the Northwest once said.
And he is so cancelled.
He is extremely cancelled. But yeah, so, I mean, in a way, it's kind of like writing about poverty. And it's writing about poverty at a time in which poverty was supposed not to exist, but actually was social exclusion, if you remember rightly. I remember social exclusion. But I was very, very keen not to kind of do it about sort of class or identification of class. I mean, it is about class in a way, but I never felt when I was working class, I never particularly felt like I was working class. I never particularly felt much kind of like I was sort of particularly at home or you know, it was my main thing I remember from growing up is just a deep feeling of alienation, which and what was sort of the period that I'm writing about there is a period when I kind of went and kind of hid from my landlord for about 2 months at my mum's then recently acquired council flat near the in Northam estate in Southampton. And it involved kind of looking at this place from which I had felt deeply alienated as a child and as a teenager, and kind of going, actually, this is all right. Actually, this is really quite interesting. And kind of finding something in it which I hadn't really realized was there. And I think that thing that I'd found and that I hadn't realized was there was the welfare state. Mm-hmm. And was that kind of legacy of kind of, you know, very, very strong legacy of kind of social provision and also kind of artistic and architectural provision that that city had had. So it's really kind of about that and about me at a point, at a fairly kind of low point for various reasons, kind of finding that thing and it not being coincidental that it's at that point that I started blogging. But in terms of it, you know, sort of thinking about it in terms of like, you know, autobiographical writing as a genre, I didn't think that much about it. And that's probably why the first draft was so poor.
Yeah. I mean, you rather put words in my, I thought it was quite an interesting experiment.
But, which failed.
Yeah, I think maybe the version that's ended up in the book is a bit more sort of natural to your type of writing, which I think is why it works better. And indeed, you know, that was what kind of attracted me to your writing and indeed to your Twitter presence, because I came to you in about 2011, I think. And yeah, certainly your interests, your political opinion, your just kind of attitude to the world, you know, really sort of fizzled and sparked out of a lot of that writing. And when I read A Guide to the New Ruins of Great Britain, you know, the sort of combination of talking about the overarching ideology of Britain and its politics at different points, ideas in architecture and city and town planning, things like sort of pop culture and pop music in particular, you know, the way you sort of combined all of these things really interested me. And I guess that leads on to the next question I want to ask, which is like, can we talk a bit about how and why you ended up focusing, of all your kind of diverse interests, how and why you ended up sort of focusing so much on housing and architecture rather than, say, pop music?
I mean, the short answer to that is because I didn't have anything to say about music that people weren't already saying better than me. So it was very crowded. You know, I there were a lot of people doing that. Some our age, some who would later do zero books, like, you know, Rian Jones and Alex Niven and so on. And who were just doing, you know, Adam Harper and another, who were just doing it and were just way better than me and had things to say that I didn't. And so it was just kind of pointless. So, you know, if I were to kind of like go through what was in my blogs early on, loads of it was about music. Absolutely loads. Loads of it was about music and loads of it was about film. And most of that doesn't really stand up because of the fact that, you know, I didn't have much to add that you know, that Mark Fisher wasn't already doing, to use a really obvious example. So I think the sort of process of trying to find out what it is I wanted to do was partly through, you know, trying not to do what he was doing because he was already doing it. And in many ways, the kind of book that one book I have written about music, which is obviously about Pulp, was partly because of the fact that because the fact that he didn't like them meant that they were territory that I could then occupy. I could write about them because it was there open that none of the other writers I liked had really gone there. And obviously the other thing is, you know, was architecture and town planning, and I knew much less about that. And one can go through, you know, the kind of writing I was doing on that at the time, both in the blog and when I first started getting hired to write, largely through my friend Bat, who at that point was an editor at Socialist Worker, and hired various blog adjacent people. I mean, he's left the SWP, obviously, because, you know, actually everyone's left the SWP who's got any basic human decency. But he, you know, sort of hired me early on. And I think there's about two essays for Socialist Worker on architecture, which are just full of schoolboy errors. And he published it because, you know, I gave the appearance of knowing what I was talking about, even though I didn't. So part of the fun of it was that you could then kind of learn about it on the hop. That was actually also a fun thing to do, was to kind of, and you see people doing this on Twitter all the time, you know, often talking with a great kind of like sense of authority about elements of the history or culture which they're actually just learning about there and then. And that's good. That's a good thing. I think the very fact that people will then, you know, either those days in the comments box or today and, you know, in the replies will, you know, suggest other paths for you to explore was really good. It was really useful to have some people like Robert Doyle, who posted as Lang Rabbi, in my comments back in the blog days, who would very politely tell me where I was wrong and tell me what I should be reading instead. But the, I suppose the, where it comes back to the introduction, and the introduction in 2005, is that it was very much an attempt at explaining to myself what had happened there, like what this kind of housing estate my mum moved to, which I really liked, how that got there. You know, how the kind of huge quantity of sort of exotic brutalism in a very unexotic city like Southampton managed to get built. Almost a sort of realization. I remember like having this real, like, deep realization reading a Penguin book, like a Penguin History of British Architecture, a collective book by four writers from the mid-60s, which I read in 2005. That's one of the first books I read in architecture, and just this feeling like, you're allowed to like this. Or rather, there was a time when you were allowed to like this. You know, it had a picture of the Alton Estate in there, in Roehampton, and I was kind of looking at it and being like, I mean, I like this, but, like, surely, you know, you like it in a kind of, like, Ballardian, you know, Brett Anderson lyric kind of, like, oh, the dystopia of the concrete towers on the West Way kind of way. And, you know, I realized that if I kind of was honest with myself, I didn't like it as a sort of, like, oh, the glamorous dystopia of the shrink-wrapped tower block, you know, kind of animal nitrate way. I liked it because I just thought it was good. I thought it was good. I thought it was good housing. I liked living in it when I was living in it. And I liked those places. And that was a really exciting revelation. And that's why I kind of ended up writing so much about it, is because I wanted to understand it for myself, both how it had happened and how it had then come to be so comprehensively demonized. Because I think that stuff, probably in about the mid-2000s, was that some sort of nadir of its popularity. It was actually just about to be, you know, kind of repopularized by various different people as a kind of, you know, form of sort of nostalgic chic. That's not quite where I came into it, although I would be lying if I said that nostalgia wasn't a factor.
Something, sticking with music for a moment, one of the specific essays in the book that I'd like to talk about briefly is the one you write on the album England Made Me by Black Box recorder Luke Haynes, also known for the Auteurs. And you write about this record being a really interesting sort of counterpoint to the sort of prevailing political attitudes that were coming through in a lot of British guitar music, particularly English guitar music at that time, and particularly, you know, a lot of the sort of darker sides of English nationalism in particular coming through that record. So can we talk a bit about why you included that particular essay in this anthology and maybe how it speaks to the sort of narrative that runs through the book as a whole?
I think one reason I put it in there is because I think it's a wonderful record. I was sort of put off a little bit by the fact that the man in question was once deeply unpleasant to me on Twitter.com, but he does this. That's his thing, is to be a bitter old git. But I think that it's a fascinating record for just insisting at that time on the sort of small-mindedness and racism and conservatism of suburban England. And there was a time, one of the things that I mentioned, and I hadn't even remembered that anyone had said this. So it was written in 2006, and it mentions, I think if I remember rightly, I got this from a Polly Toynbee column, this belief that because of New Labour, who had just, of course, won the 2005 election, although it actually won less votes than the Tories in England, under Michael Howard, running an explicitly racist campaign, which you might remember, "Are you thinking what we're thinking?" was the slogan. And it would usually have some sort of, like, you know, big slogan about criminals or asylum seekers or whatever. And then, "Are you thinking what we're thinking?"
To be fair, Labour run an explicitly racist campaign as well. But
Yeah. But the thing with Labour doing it is that it was always done in that kind of, like, as they always do everything, because they're such a success IPO-faced. It's always done with that kind of heavy heart kind of way, you know. There's a difference in, like, Harriet Harman going, like, "Reluctantly, I think we're going to have to..." And, you know, Michael Howard at that point going, "Send her back! These are different things." You know, there's a different, you know, it's like, goes back to the old, you know, the old thing in you know, about the difference between, you know, ordinary conservatism and fascism. So the, I feel I've kind of, because you've mentioned them, you've taken me off the I've not got out my klaxon.
I was promised the klaxon, yeah.
The L word is not to be mentioned. Yeah. Michael Howard. Anyway, so there was this phrase from this Polytoynbee article about, like, oh, Britain has a progressive consensus. You know, everyone now believes in progressive things. You know, we all support, you know, LGBT rights. We're all anti-racist. We all kind of believe in a mixed economy, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, are you fucking serious? Have you spoken to anyone? You know, like this was the period in which, like, you know, the Daily Mail became the most popular paper in the country. It's around the time when UKIP go from being a sort of joke party to, you know, within a few years, you know, winning the Euro elections. You know, it's this period where, like, that kind of purple poster starts to appear, the kind of purple UKIP poster starts to appear in places. You know, the tabloids were in this constant kind of, like, screaming pitch about bogus asylum seekers and Muslim terrorists and pedos, which strangely never seemed to include, you know, the huge quantity of ruling class pedos that we now know. And, yeah, all of that was happening, and yet these sort of Guardian-type people seem to think that we'd kind of, like, crossed over into this kind of, like, you know, sort of fantastic kind of Will Alsop neo-Barcelona where we were all liberal. And one of the things I really like about the album is it's an album from that time going, like, no, 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 this is what you are. Like, you are still this. Which makes it in many ways quite a bleak listen, but I think it captures an enormous kind of truth of that time that I think a huge amount of people, particularly in suburban areas in the South, but later, as we would learn in much of the rest of the country, really didn't like this and were waiting for their moment to take their revenge. So it was just quite funny looking at it in 2020 and going, like, oh, you can trace a line from this to this, basically.
Did you at any point reading that back in 2020 imagine how 2006 Owen might have responded if 15 years later you were to tell him that 15 years later, Polly Toynbee would be saying that the voters have no excuse for not liking centrism?
I mean, again, it was kind of not, I'm not really trying to suggest here that we all knew what was going to happen. We didn't. But it was pretty obvious that this stuff wasn't actually popular and it wasn't working. And one of the things that sort of, I don't remember the phraseology exactly, but there was a particular kind of K-punk riff about, like, populism that no one actually likes. And I think he was talking specifically about New Labour, but also talking about lots of, like, crap British TV of that period, that you kind of aim for the lowest common denominator and miss. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of that about. There was lots of sort of, like, talking down to people constantly, and the people that you were talking down to just ignoring you altogether. So that was very much a thing that we were thinking of. Well, obviously, we didn't see the extent of what was going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the first iteration of Love Island in, I think, 2005, which was a disastrous flop. And I thought, okay, that's the lowest common denominator the Glamours have missed. And now here we are. What a world we live in.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Anyway, let's like move the conversation on from that a little bit, although this does sort of relate. And we've said we're not going to talk about the L word, and we shouldn't because it sucks. But one of the sort of narratives I think does get traced through the book, and it's in the Black Box Recorder article we just talked about, is a sort of resurgence of far right ideas and politics. And one of the things that's explored in the book is the way that makes a sort of, you know, inches back into a sort of mainstream, you know, a lot of sort of complacent sort of 90s end of history type saying, oh, it'll never come back. And throughout the 2000s and 2010s, most notably in the essay you write about architecture in Hungary, but also the essay you write about sort of legacies of German expressionism and the German far right, you talk about the way architecture, in particular a phrase you use that I picked out, restorative classicism, is a means of sort of mainstreaming kind of far-right ideas during that period. So can we talk a bit about how that comes into the book and into the specific pieces that are included?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I suppose, you know, the idea of a sort of resurgence, I mean, I suppose, you know, I'm very much aware that my sort of perspective on these things growing up in somewhere that was kind of ultra, ultra politicized to the point of it being slightly ridiculous means that I it's probably a bit kind of atypical. But, you know, I remember going on the demonstration against the BNP when they had their councillor in the Isle of Dogs march to their headquarters in Welling in South East London. I remember going on that when I was 12, you know. I remember, like, you know, the there was a big resurgence in street fascism. I remember the estate that I lived on in the mid-90s in the outskirts of Southampton having a major National Front presence, not even BNP, National Front. I don't think any of that had ever been really dealt with. And by and large, it had been sort of pandered to. Although there was this sort of idea that, like, you could sort of do things and pander to it at once, a kind of classic triangulation strategy. But the stuff in the book about Hungary and Germany is a bit different because I don't really want to. I think you can and can't compare, like, you know, Farage and Horthy, or, like, you know, Rod Little and Ernst Jünger. You know, I mean, they're kind of similar and they're kind of not. You know, maybe the fash had better intellectuals in those days, I don't know. What they're very much about is kind of architecture and nationalism as a kind of alternative to the sort of modern movement that I very much romanticize. You know, that I think one can nuance this quite a great deal. There are places where there's kind of a tie between modernism and nationalism, Italy to a degree. But by and large, especially in Germany and in Central Europe in general, there was a very kind of strict divide between, you know, kind of people who were doing this kind of international and hence Bolshevik, hence Jewish architecture, and then people that were trying to, you know, go down into, like, the German earth and clay and, you know, build with the real mobs of Germany. And, you know, a lot of that stuff in expressionism, which was deeply nationalistic, didn't really feed into the architecture of the Third Reich very much because Hitler had very, very boring taste in architecture and just was into a really kind of dull kind of Poundbury classicism. So, but I was that comes from a review of a series of books called Fragments of Metropolis, which came out from a sort of, I think, impeccably liberal the German architecture publisher. You probably would have no idea of the kind of connotations at the time of this stuff. And I was just sort of going through it, just looking up all the architects and all of these kind of expressionist architects who were all designing this kind of very the heavy architecture of brick and spires, this kind of Northern Gothic architecture. Loads of them were Nazis. And, you know, there was very much, it was based on this kind of, like, I suppose, that, you know, we're all kind of in the business of trying to find usable past. And I think what this was doing was trying to find a usable past for contemporary German architecture, which is usually a kind of modernized classicism in a lot of cases, something like the kind of, you know, the Humboldt Forum project that's happening right now. It's basically a kind of, like, basically a kind of 1930s fascist building of an 18th century dome on top. And, you know, it was sort of trying to kind of find a usable past for this by finding a past for it that wasn't the Nazis, basically. So it all stops in 1933. And one of the main architects of this, who actually introduces one of these books, is a guy called Hans Kohlhoff, who recently got in a lot of shit in the German architectural press when it was found that he had inscribed, somehow no one had noticed this up to this point, some verses from Ezra Pound's Cantos in one of his buildings, which was a neoclassical kind of complex in the west of Berlin called Walter Benjamin Platz. So literally dedicated to, you know, a Marxist Jewish victim of fascism, whose own kind of architectural interests were in kind of iron and glass and kind of very, very high-tech modernism. And sticking, you know, building a classical complex based on the kind of solidity and eternal nature of stone, and then putting like an inscription from Ezra Pound talking about usura in there. And I thought this is extraordinary that he'd gotten away with this. Absolutely extraordinary. And you know, in Germany, you have this kind of situation in which, you know, someone supporting BDS is like absolutely anti-Semite, but someone like literally quoting like one of fascism's main ideologues, you know, propounding a fascist theory on a building dedicated to a victim of fascism, was simply not noticed for a very long time. And I think that kind of speaks to a lot of the ways in which fascism is sort of remembered. One of the things that sort of often extricated from how it's discussed as fascism's kind of enormous suspicion of modernity and its enormous hatred of the left. Mm-hmm. And I think now that you can see, you know, kind of, I think a sort of fascist movement in formation in lots of the world, I don't think it's quite there yet, but it's there. It's kind of forming on you know, on the internet and in various political movements. These are two things they absolutely loathe. They absolutely passionately, deeply loathe the left as their primary enemy. And they deeply loathe modernity and particularly modern architecture. Interesting seeing those things recur in that regard.
Yeah. And I want to ask one more question. I'm just a bit conscious of time. I want to ask one more question. It's kind of a counterpoint to that. And I think it's a general point that I'd like to address through a specific essay in the book that really struck me, which is, yeah, I mean, you talk about them hating the left, and as a counterpoint to, you know, these sort of ideas being mainstream partly through architecture, so far right ideas coming in, you also sort of document ways in which architecture and town planning are used as a means of sort of destroying resistance to conservatism and of preventing sort of left-wing cultures forming and erasing ones that already exist. And so a lot of your writing is a means of either protesting or trying to inspire resistance to that, or chronicling people who are standing up against it. And one of the most interesting essays here is on a poet and writer and sort of political activist, I guess, called Andrew Jordan, who was based, like yourself, on the South Coast in the sort of Solent region, ran a group, which is, I think, maybe just him, called Proles for Modernism, and was very animated by the destruction of the really incredible Tricorn Centre in Portsmouth. So perhaps an audience start putting your questions in the Q&A, but before we do that, perhaps you'd like to talk about like who Andrew Jordan was and why you wrote about him, and maybe who commissioned that long essay on Andrew Jordan, because it's a very long piece on a, you know, a very marginal figure. And it struck me, I don't know when it was written, but I don't know how likely it would be to get commissioned now, where it might be published. So maybe we could talk a bit about that as well.
Mm-hmm. So the essay was originally commissioned by a guy called Jonathan Charlie, who's very much an architect, very much from the far left, based in Glasgow, who was doing a kind of anthology in like architecture and literature in the city, a Routledge. And I had wanted to write about Andy's work for a long time. And so Jonathan asked me to write for this anthology, and I was like, right, this is an opportunity to do this. And I, you know, obviously I wasn't going to get paid and no one was really going to read it. But that's one reason why it's in this book. I just knew that in this Routledge anthology, it would be read only by 20 people. Sorry, Jonathan. So I was really keen that I kind of get it in something that people might actually read. So I came across his stuff in Celia Clark's book on the Tricorns. Really wonderful, kind of strange, picaresque kind of montage book on the Tricorn and the campaign to save it. Not a lot of people know that there was a campaign to save the Tricorn Centre, like well before lots of the modernist revival stuff. And one of the reasons for that was because of the fact that it was a really weird bit of Portsmouth. You know, it was kind of you know, half of it was derelict, but it's where the kind of, you know, it's where the comic shop and the record shop would be in Portsmouth. You know, it was the kind of cool place if you were cool in Portsmouth. And obviously I'm from, you know, the other side of the M27 in Southampton, so I know Portsmouth pretty well. And I kind of like, I guess as I followed his work from there, he then kind of, the next thing I came across of his was a book called Bonehead's Utopia, which is about HMP Haslar, which was a migrant holding centre in Gosport, which is, roughly speaking, Portsmouth's Birkenhead, if you can imagine the geography there. Yeah, and I just sort of pedaled backwards, sort of, you know, kind of trying to find all of the things he'd read. And he then sent them to me, basically, because I expressed, we started corresponding. Up to that point, the only thing he'd really been in was a Stuart Home anthology called Mind Invaders. And I think that was really the only way he'd been sort of outside of sort of poetry circles. And he writes this very kind of apocalyptic kind of, I wouldn't call it Blakeian because that's such a cliche, but writes this kind of very kind of apocalyptic, kind of intense poetry about the, I wouldn't call it South Coast. South Coast is like Sussex. That's the South Coast. Solent is not the South Coast. Solent is ports and industry and, you know, and the military and container ships and factories. It's a different thing entirely. And hardly anyone has written properly about it. You know, there was really kind of like Jonathan Meads has done it a little bit. There's Philip Hoare's book Spike Island, which is really good on the Netley Hospital. But really, there's extraordinarily little. And he really kind of explores the place through really enormous kind of like layers and layers of the kind of the history of it, and particularly in places like Portsdown Hill, which is a sort of enormous kind of chalk cliff above Portsea Island, sort of looming over Portsmouth, which has just been used for, you know, centuries as a military base. And it's also right next to Paul's Grove. And for another kind of, you know, 2000 nostalgia thing, if people remember the Paul's Grove riots, which is where I think a paediatrician had been housed there or something like that. Someone had been housed there and the News of the World revealed their address and there were riots for days and days in Paul's Grove. And, you know, it was a very deeply kind of abandoned place, Paul's Grove. Like, you know, they had all sorts of reasons to be fucking furious. Maybe the paediatricians weren't really one of them. But and his work kind of imagines, I suppose, particularly in his last book, Hegemonic, kind of imagines a sort of uprising of the people of that place against his kind of centuries old oppression. And he, you know, he does the kind of thing I think, which I miss people doing, of kind of putting out lots of sort of zines and pamphlets and so on, and kind of publishing this kind of very kind of sort of marginal stuff. And you know, I really wanted to kind of point people to it. I recently sent him the book and wrote him an email, and he proceeded to explain to me that Bill Gates and Tony Blair were going to get control of my mind and body via the vaccine. So he's that kind of dude.
Right. Well, that seems like a good place to go to questions, as long as they're not about like COVID vaccine conspiracies.
Matthew Letizia, also an anti-vaxxer. It's something in the region.
Well, quite, yeah. I mean, Craig David's opinions as yet. but yeah, we have just under 10 minutes for questions. So the only one I've had so far is just Colin, who asks, what are your thoughts on class and conservation?
That's more of a comment than a question, Colin, I believe.
It's a very general question. Do with it what you will. There are any essays in the book that refer to it, then
I mean there are and they're largely to do with brutalism conservation. They're not to do with sort of, you know, more historic building conservation, but definitely to do with the way that modern buildings have been conserved. And there's a really it's sort of slightly annoying because I can't point you yet to the essay that I would point you to because we have not published it yet, but the Tribune culture section, which I edit, Tess Pinto, later for the 20th Century Society, has sent a fantastic essay about Bologna and about the historic building conservation in Bologna in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and how it was deeply linked with class politics. So it wasn't a kind of, you know, we're going to kind of restore all of these buildings to improve the property values. You know, it was very much kind of like, we're going to do this as a collective project in order to keep ordinary people living in the heart of the city type stuff. And a really rare kind of combination of these two things. And she goes into quite a lot of detail about the way that kind of heritage and building restoration funding is apportioned to make a case for why it is that generally building conservation and people whose main interest is property development and property values has often gone together. And it's often been a way of removing people from historic buildings and removing one sort of people from historic buildings, whether it's Islington in the 70s or whether it's things like Balfron Tower or Park Hill or Keeling House nowadays, removing them from the historic buildings as a condition seemingly of their conservation. Yeah, there's always been a kind of real opposition between those two things, actually. There's been an opposition between the people that live in those buildings and their conservation a lot of the time. And that's not necessary. It's not something inherent to building conservation, but something inherent to the way it's done in the UK. And there was a recent example of a sort of famous brutalist social housing complex in Geneva, quite similar in many ways to Park Hill in Sheffield, being restored for its original inhabitants. And it's taken 11 years and it's beautiful and nobody was moved out. And, you know, it's entirely possible to do. It's just something inherent in the way things are done here.
Yeah, we don't have any more from the audience yet. So I'm going to ask a question and again, do with it this what you will. The final essay in the book is a long essay about Mark Fisher that I think was originally commissioned for a Russian publication by our friend Kirill Kobrin, who's very interesting writer and personality. And, you know, after a delay of a few years, you've published this in English at the end of this anthology. Can we talk a bit about why it's taken you a few years to publish that essay and to what extent it is sort of trying to deal with, you know, the influence of Mark on that blogging culture that you started off in?
Yeah. I mean, I want to be very clear in talking about this. I always feel like I need to do lots of disclaimers about this because I knew him very much at a certain period. Like, you know, we hadn't been in touch particularly regularly for a good few years when he died. You know, we had been in touch, but certainly not regularly. I mean, we used to be in touch, you know, every couple of days. So it's not really like the argument, and it's not really intended to kind of like have a go at other people's interpretations that much, with some exceptions on certain essays, certain very famous essays where I think everyone's got it wrong. I suppose the reason I did it at the time is it seemed very heated, very, very heated, you know, particularly where people stood on the Vampire Castle essay, which is obviously what I'm referring to. And I just, yeah, I wanted to kind of, and it was a commission. It was a commission from Kirill for you know, for a Russian journal, and I did it as a favor to Kirill, and as I, in the course of writing it, ended up getting a lot off my chest. It's obviously mainly it's a tribute to him, but I wanted to not treat him as a saint. And there is that thing that happens when people die, that they are treated as saints. They you know, their flaws are kind of ignored, and they're kind of, you know, turned into kind of angelic figures. And I mean, you know, he could sometimes be slightly angelic, but, you know, he was often very much not. So I wanted to kind of write about, and I also wanted to kind of like test the claims that were being made. You know, that you did see people say when that anthology was published that this is, you know, the work of the greatest cultural critic of the last 10 or 20 years or whatever. And, and people would usually mention quite a small group of essays to make that point, make reference to quite a small group of texts, which often didn't really do justice to quite how strange and cranky and often just completely irrational and uneven a lot of that work is. So, yeah, there's a sort of element of record straight putting in there. And because of that, I was initially a bit kind of like, give it a bit of time before publishing this anywhere that anyone in Britain can read it. There's some questions, I can see them.
Yeah, there's. Well, I'm going to ask one more question because I'm aware of the time.
Abuse and, your chair. You know,
yes, I will.
I can see two. Yet.
You can see two. Okay. Well, I mean,
I can see that on two different boxes. No,
yeah. let's take them both then. Let's take this first one very quickly, which is Where Next is from Kieran and says, "Where next for the post-COVID city tour anthology? Would you do a Nairn and go America?"
I have no particular interest in going America. there are two projects along those lines. Very glad you are. One of which is quite short and quite silly, which I kind of did because it kind of came to me in a dream, and then I woke up laughing and I thought, haha, let's do this, which is a city tour anthology on the idea of Kanzo, the kind of like bizarre kind of Tory right idea that on leaving the EU, we're going to kind of form a union with the white dominions. And having been to all three of those countries, having been to Canada, Australia, and New Zealand a little bit, Australia the least of the three, sadly, I have a sort of essay I wrote that I've kind of been working for ages and ages about New Zealand, which kind of place that I had enormous kind of love-hate feelings towards on spending a few weeks there. And it's sort of cobbling them together, basically. And, you know, it's Niall Ferguson's Utopia. Is it real? That's what that book is. And there's a book I've wanted to do for ages and ages and ages as a follow-up to Landscapes of Communism about East Asia and about sort of developmentalism and Leninism and the links between them and the kind of results in city building in East Asia. And that will take years and years and years. None of these involve going to America, unless you count Canada as America. And I've already done.
Well, as David Byrne once sang, I wouldn't live there if you paid me.
You're quite.
one more question again.
The great Satan is not being discussed in my work.
No, me neither. So there's a question from Barney who says, with Gottfried Böhm dying the other day, I got gripped by a maudlin sense of living memory. It sounds like your book is reclaiming your experiences as your own. Is modern housing all in the past?
I mean, it has done well in some places. I think it's just the thing of it being, it's the sort of under difficult circumstances. So rare. Like I had a really interesting talk recently with them.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
My friend Christian Virtualter, who lives in Cologne, we were talking about Baugruppe. And Baugruppe are kind of basically a form of kind of communal housing that's popular in German cities, which basically is all of the things I want in housing. Your own kind of flat and your own bit and balcony, and then lots of communal areas and very much in the heart of the city. This is how I think everything should be, obviously. And they still do that here and here, still do that there. And here it's enormously difficult to come by anything like that. That stuff is certainly not still built. You know, a sort of collectively owned, you know, social housing project based on like widespread communal space. This is just not a thing that happens in Britain. It does still happen in Germany, but basically for people that, you know, that already are, you know, that are in the know, you know, it's very popular with sort of aging hipsters. I'm sure, you know, all of the members of Einstersende Neubauten now live in a Baugruppe somewhere. You know, it's just like, it's a thing for a particular kind of group, social group of people. And that idea that this is a thing that you would do for everybody is a thing that really is hard to find being done anywhere. And, you know, neoliberalism is a real thing, whatever the poll profs say, and it's a global thing. And so you do find, the most encouraging things I find are always things like that. The Baugruppe in Germany, you know, things like the LILAC housing scheme in Leeds, the community land trust there. You know, these things are really, you know, kind of fascinating and inspiring things, but they are done for a particular group of enthusiasts, you know, and that's not going to wash, you know, as the next few decades unfold themselves. It's not going to wash.
Well, I think that's all we've got time for. Let us not speak of the poll prof. Clean Living Under Difficult Circumstances, published by Verso, available now. I think we've put a link in the chat where you can buy it from the London Review Bookshop. It looks gorgeous, as always. It matches Owen's jumper, which I think is a good thing.
And the poster.
And the poster, quite. Wonderful. All right, Owen. Well, thank you so much for joining me. I look forward to your forthcoming non-American work audience. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you all soon.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.